I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast.
The year is 1980. The album is Monty Python's Contractual Obligation album. The artist, of course, Monty Python, produced by friend of the show, Andre Jacquemin, and guest David Melville this week. Thank you so much for coming on again.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back. I love doing this.
Third time, fourth time?
Is that third time?
Third time. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I love that you picked, because the previous two times have been a bit of an education, but I've heard most of this album, so I actually can talk, maybe not with any authority, but at least with some familiarity with this, you know, because when you pick George Formby, I'm like, this is fun, but I don't know, I have nothing to
right do. And what is it, Hoffnung we did,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Crap, that's what I was gonna do. Yeah. I have two more Hoffnung albums I was gonna bring with me just to show them to you to see if you've seen them before. Yeah. I've since picked them up for nothing. I think they might just be musical albums, might be strictly musical, but the art on the cover is beautiful and everything. This cover, however, easily and intentionally one of their stupidest covers. It was an actual contractual. They're actually fulfilling a contractual obligation.
It was, yes. They were. They had a record deal with Charisma, and they were just doing a filler album just to complete their contract.
I've got to say, though, for a filler album, it's got a lot of stuff that I remember very, very fondly.
Yeah, it's got some. I mean, there's some absolute gems on this, and then there's some misses, and there's some, there's one downright failure. But the cover's interesting because it doesn't have any Terry Gilliam artwork on it.
Right.
It just says, can TG do a nice eye-catching cover to help it sell EI? And then underneath it, not really worth it, TJ. So all you get is like a photo of the inner sleeve crumpled up.
Big stamp on the front. And yours is, like I said, very well worn. So this is your original copy. Did you get it in 1980 or a few years later?
I didn't. I did a little research on this. I think I must have bought it in 1982, 83, because I think this is the second pressing.
Okay.
Because there was a song on it where John Denver was being strangled. And for legal reasons, it had to be removed, and it was replaced by a lawyer's opinion, which is the second track on it. So I have that one. But yeah, I got it, and so I don't know, how old was I back then? Probably about 14, 13 or 14, I think I got this.
Perfect.
And Monty Python's very dear to my heart. But what's interesting about it is that I really only knew Monty Python through records as a younger person.
Okay.
Because the TV show, the BBC hardly ever repeated. I remember seeing as a child, my parents were flipping through the channels, and you couldn't really flip through the channels in those days because there were only two, but they were between the channels, they were flipping, and I think they landed on Monty Python for a little bit, and there was the Terry Gilliam little cartoon about house hunting, and there were men with rifles shooting at a house, which I just thought was brilliant. And then my father, you know, grumbled and turned back to the cricket or the what are they, or darts, or you know, bowls, you know, or something like that. So that was and until I moved to America, I don't think I'd ever seen a full episode of the TV show.
Really?
Because they would play it on PBS.
Sure. Yeah.
But in the UK, they never really repeated it that much. And there was the movie, And Now for Something Completely Different.
Sure.
Which, when my parents finally agreed to get a video recorder, I managed to get tape of that. And that's, so the records in that movie were all I really knew.
That's great. That's not dissimilar from my experience, only because my parents, I feel like Monty Python might have been something they were holding back from me. There's some things that they thought if I misunderstood it, I wouldn't, it might throw me. They wouldn't let me watch Rocky Horror until I was a bit older. They wouldn't let me watch Blazing Saddles until I was older. Two things that ended up being two of my favorites. And then I can't remember if Monty Python was one of those or not, but I first watched like Holy Grail in the basement of a church, and not religious people, but somehow I was at a church watching Holy Grail there. And that was my, but then I didn't watch the show because we didn't have access to it. It wasn't even playing on PBS at that time when I was growing up and watching it. So, and I had only the albums to listen to. And I still think the albums are superior to the show in a lot of ways. I think they're brilliantly produced.
They are, yeah. And you can listen to them over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And imitate them, which I'm sure I did as a teenager.
Of course you did.
It was very annoying.
Did you have other friends, though, who knew Monty Python at all?
Well, I was at boarding school when I got into this.
Okay.
And I had a friend whose name was Webb.
Mm-hmm.
That was not his... that's his last name, because we were only referred to each other by last names.
Okay, okay.
A first name is too much intimacy.
Sure, sure, sure.
For a British boarding school. So Webb, when we got into, when we became prefects, you had the luxury of being able to bring a cassette recorder and radio to school.
Okay.
Before that, there was nothing.
Sure.
And he brought some cassettes of Monty Python. I think that was listening to the Drury Lane album.
Mm-hmm.
That was when I got into it. And when I went home for the holidays, I bought some of the records. So yeah, he and I were really into it, and we would sort of quote it at each other. And yeah.
What else were you? So okay, so you said like maybe 82 is when you picked this up. So what else were you listening to in terms of music? Or comedy? Was there any other comedy?
Yeah, I was. I always had an affinity for comedy, so I was listening to. My father had. I don't think I have it here. My dad died about a year and a half ago, so I just shipped all his records and the record player. Finally, I have a record player.
Mm-hmm.
Out to the U.S. and there's some Peter Sellers ones. There's one that he does with Sophia Loren.
What?
Goodness
really?
Gracious me!
I've never heard this.
Which I'm sure would not fly today.
Okay.
Because, you know, it was a little bit racist.
Okay, yep, sure.
Peter Sellers. I would watch all the sitcoms on the Two Ronnies. Do you know the Two Ronnies?
I do. I have one of their albums somewhere.
I think I have an album there.
The BBC did that a lot. I mean, if a show is big enough, they'd release like a full episode, either the full episodes or select sketches if it was a sketch show.
Yeah.
I've got one of the Fawlty Towers ones. It's one episode on either side.
I have a Fawlty Towers one as well. And mm-hmm. And I think for my parents, I don't think they really understood Monty Python.
Okay.
Although they both had terrific sense of humor, though I think that it was not, because... Yes, sort of subversive.
Sure.
And, you know, it does take pot shots at class and stuff like
yeah.
that. So I don't think they really quite got it, but then they loved Fawlty Towers.
Okay.
So I think once they got into Fawlty Towers, then they were willing to take a look at Monty Python.
Okay, so they softened on it just a little bit.
Yeah.
Were they the generation of Python, or like just a few years older, or a few years
a couple of years older, but essentially the same. Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting to me, because I you can never tell. I'm always curious, because there's always these groundbreakers who, if you then pick, I'm trying to think of any artist who is my age and who hit, you know, when we were the same age, that I might even appreciate. So I might be completely missing some stuff entirely because they're my age and they're actually geared toward just a few years younger than me.
Right.
It's such a weird disconnect, because in my head, Monty Python is a huge cultural shift, but they weren't really. I mean, they were kind of a sleeper. At some point, like, because they made it overseas and because they had a big hit film and because they had enough religious controversy attached, they're now in history solidified as, you know, the greatest thing on the planet.
Yes, it's interesting. They're not really attached to a particular movement. I mean, you couldn't say that Monty Python came out of the psychedelic 60s or anything.
Right,
like that.
Yeah.
Although, you know, they obviously were popular with that demographic, but... they were just absolutely their own thing. I mean, mm-hmm. they were their own invention, and they were riffing on, you know, the building blocks of British comedy, but mm-hmm. they took that and they just, you know, threw this sort of absurdist, you know, stuff at it and just ran with it. And it really is its own thing. But I think that as a child getting into it, or, you know, teenager, initially it's the silliness that gets you, and
of
you know
course.
their willingness to say rude words and mm-hmm. you know, maybe show a pair of breasts and
sure.
you know lob some grenades at organized religion and stuff like that you know, cuz you know you have to go to church every week, and
sure
it's, you know, it's the absurdity, they shine a light on the absurdity of religion, the ridiculous, rituals that, the dressing up and the sacraments and the, right. the things which, when you think about it, really, they are kind of bizarre.
Yeah.
And, they're shining a light on that, but no, as a kid, it's the rude words and the boobs.
Mm-hmm. And for me, it was the accents. That's another thing entirely different because I didn't have any of that.
Right.
And there is that extra thing where people with accents are funny. There absolutely becomes that association for a long time if you don't know any better.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So with the Shakespeare Festival in the park, every once in a while, someone will refer to me as the Monty Python guy.
Oh, God.
Which, obviously is meant as a compliment.
Yes.
And I certainly would take it as that, but it kind of made me wary of picking a Monty Python record the uh-huh. first time to do this, because it's, I don't really see myself that way.
Right.
And maybe it's just because I have the similar accent or something.
Maybe.
But as a performer, I have an ear for absurdism and,
sure.
That sort of sense of humor, but I think mm-hmm. I find myself actually much more influenced by Peter Sellers and mm-hmm. Peter Cook and people like that,
right?
Than necessarily Monty Python. But.
Well, that is going to be that's the funny thing. If that's your go-to funny English, then I guess that's it. That's what everything is.
Right.
The Monty Python guy. That is so funny to me. That is not the
well,
first
and
thing
the and the first time I heard it was in, right after I played Richard II. It was not like I was doing, Festy in Twelfth Night or something. No,
mm-hmm. Oh my God. I'm trying to now think which Monty Python, which member of the group you were, because that's really funny to me. That's really funny to me that would strike anybody. That's the first thing they would think. Yeah.
I suppose it must be the accent and the.
Sure.
Maybe the delivery a little bit. I don't know.
I mean, you're a very animated actor when you're doing comedy, but then I've also seen, we've talked about this before, but I've seen you put comedy into things I never expected to see comedy put into, like Hamlet was much funnier than I would have expected, again, lighter anyway in some parts, which made the drama that much richer. But yeah, that's interesting to me. That's very funny. What can you, I hate asking this question, but can you peg any influences specifically from the group? Is there anybody in the group who you related more to and, oh, this is a voice I like to do the most, or this is a guy I would, if I was going to do a sketch, I'd play this guy's characters most?
I suppose, John Cleese, I guess, is really recognized as the star,
mm-hmm.
but I don't really go towards him too much. He has a bunch of characters that are pretty extreme. He does this person that kind of talks like that. I've never done that one.
Right.
I mean, I've never really consciously sort of...
Sure.
But I do think that sometimes Michael Palin, the way he does certain accents kind of, I find really quite charming,
mm-hmm.
Why that's just the everyday kind of bloke,
mm-hmm.
So maybe sometimes that I love them all. I don't think I could pick a favorite.
Sure, yeah.
They all have their sort of unique gifts. I love Terry Jones,
of course.
And I've read some of his books as well. Have you mm-hmm. ever read any?
No,
of
I haven't.
They're really fascinating. His history books.
Mm-hmm.
So he's probably the one I have the sort of most affinity with.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's more for me, rather than the voices, it's the way they handle pace
mm-hmm.
Within the sketches, but also in the television show and the records, how things line up and they suddenly cut and jump to another thing and they juxtapose. A lot of their sketches are about juxtaposing odd things, putting odd things together, but, sort of slow pace and then quick pace and then
sure.
suddenly jump, as they... surprising jump to something else coming out of nowhere, and that's so I think maybe in terms of the musicality of how they perform is something that I have as a director and an actor sort of at the back of my mind.
I can see that. Yeah, I mean, this album I had also forgotten. I'm so glad you picked it, because we talked about this before, but I've never gotten to speak too heavily on it. The Rock Notes sketch on this, which I'm sorry, I was looking at this as though this was going to give me an actual track listing. The cover does have a legitimate
it's on the
track
inside.
Listing. Yes, right. There we go.
It's on the sleeve.
There we are.
You have to pull it out. And it...
And yeah, this is insane. It's also, again, filled with ridiculous, stupid notes that are mostly BS. But
oh, look, it does. It says farewell to John Denver, and there's a big censored stamp put on it.
Amazing. Yeah. That's so good. But rock notes, if you want to talk about, I was going to say, without the accent, Eric Idle is probably the biggest influence on me, because that one sketch has influenced everything I've ever written since.
Really?
Yes.
Because that's the one where it's the trout pneumonia sauce and,
you know. Yes. Pure flowing brain nonsense that doesn't stop. It also gave the band Toad the Wet Sprocket their name. But he's got this pure, and I probably had seen the Ruddles before this, but then after, just there is, he delivers it, and it I don't know. I've never properly articulated what it is about that, but the nonsense of it. And the way he so clearly delivers it, as if
it's the mastery
something.
Of the performance of it, because yeah. It's very quick. It's like a Gilbert and Sullivan song.
Uh-huh.
Or
yeah,
it's
yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's very complicated
mm-hmm.
Articulation.
Right.
And he doesn't, you know, fuck it up. But
right.
I mean, maybe he does.
Maybe, who knows.
We didn't hear all the other takes, mm-hmm. but...
There's just so many good jokes in it. And they're just... And they're quick. They're seeming throwaways.
Yeah.
It's not unlike the Australian Table Wines from the other album.
Right.
I can't remember which one it is. But it's just him reading. And it shouldn't be funny.
And I think that might be from Rutland Weekend Television.
Is it? Okay, see,
yeah, because there's a lot of filler stuff. They didn't really want to make this record.
Right.
I don't think Cleese is really, and he's in a couple of, he's in the
one
string
two, yeah.
sketch and a couple of bits.
Mm-hmm.
They just finished Life of Brian,
mm-hmm.
which obviously, you know, was a high point for them.
Sure.
And then they had to do this. And so there's stuff that, it's a real mix of stuff, because there's stuff that goes back to pre-Python, like the 1948
yes,
show. And stuff
right.
like, you know, apparently there's some stuff from back there, which, you know, and, you know, I think you can tell some
I think
of the
Bookshop
moment.
Goes back that far, because
right.
he's playing a part that was supposed to be played by, oh my God. Marty Feldman. Sorry,
Feldman.
There we go. Yeah,
oh
that's it took me a million years. Bookshop, also one of my favorite sketches as well, because, again, pure nonsense, but it's not as, to me, less impressive, yeah. just because Rock Notes is all just red.
Right.
It shouldn't be funny.
Right. Yes, exactly. It's, I think what's great about this record is the songs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they have a lot of songs on it.
This gets recycled later into Monty Python Sings is half this and half whichever other album it is, but it's almost all the music is on Monty Python Sings, which is how.
Oh, really?
Yes. Which I think
know.
How I discovered Monty Python. It's just a compilation, but that's how I discovered
yeah.
my favorite stuff of theirs, I think.
Well, so track one is Sit on My Face and Tell Me That You Love Me. just, like this barbershop choir singing,
mm-hmm.
you know, very, you know, deadpan. which, as a teenager, obviously, was very appealing.
Of course. And they got in hot water for that one, I think, too, because that was because it was based on an old war song, which is, oh my God, what is it? Well, whatever it is. It's the same exact tune.
Oh, really? War song.
Yes. I'd have to find it and pull it up, but sung by this very matronly, you know, woman, and it's supposed to be very patriotic, rah-rah, England.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Vera Lynn or someone, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I guess they got in trouble for that because it wasn't, you know, respectful enough, which is amazing to me.
Wow.
But they absolutely had to take the John Denver song off, which is very quick, by the way. And if nobody's ever heard it, it's just very, it's just Eric Idle do it. I believe he's singing the line, "You came on my pillow," and then he gets strangled. It's so stupid. It's so stupid.
It is, and apparently they put it back on from a pressing.
Did they? Okay, that must be.
And then
be
John
how
Denver
I heard it.
Died, and then they took it off again.
Oh, beautiful timing. That is beautiful.
But
so
then,
what else do we have on here?
Well, never be rude to an Arab, which is
mm-hmm.
That really should have been censored
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. or left off.
Right. I mean, it's touchy. I mean, it's supposed to be anti-racism, but I think they use all the words, so it's like, okay, that one's a rough one to listen to.
Well, it's when they get to the N word, it's like
mm-hmm.
This is a fail.
Right.
And I know, I guess, you know, people could get away with that more in 1980 than now, but
sure.
it's just not, it's exactly the same structure as a gag as brilliant. Where is it? Lay on the second side. I bet you it's the first song on the second side. I bet you won't play this song on the radio.
Yes, right. Which is all just creative bleeping.
Yes, and there's a sort of glee in saying all that stuff and it being bleeped, and you know, the idea that it won't get on the radio, but you're listening to it anyway, and there's sort of a fun in that. But you know, never be rude to an Arab. You're saying all these derogatory terms. But you know, there's not any glee in that,
right?
And you know, the song is instructing you not to do this, but doing it anyway.
It's a weird, like, darkly ironic thing to throw on a throwaway album, where it's like you spent all this time thinking about putting this very dark, upsetting thing together. It's like you couldn't have done one more. I hadn't thought about it in that way, but yeah, you couldn't have done one more like cheery, stupid song like that. Yeah,
and I'm sure that the Monty Python team would not think of themselves as racist,
sure,
and they're making a point.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I don't think you can make those jokes.
No,
there's some places you can't go. It's you know, comedy is always, you know, good comedy, exciting comedy is about treading a fine line.
Sure,
you know, about taking risks, When I play the Dr. Pinch character, when we do our vaudeville shows and the concerts and the stuff, I have to check in with the team, you know, to make sure that some of the our bass guitarist is ex-bass guitarist was Jewish, so I would say, is it okay to say this?
Right,
And he was like, yeah, no, that's funny, you can say that, because Dr. Pinch is German and. May or may not have been a participant in things during World War II.
Well, that's the big difference, too. And I've thought about this a lot. Obviously, my thoughts as a white man are so important. But, getting a cosine from a well-thought-out joke, and if am I making my point or am I just being egregious, is like, that's such the smartest thing to do.
Yeah.
There's not a member of Monty Python who isn't white.
It was not a diverse show, either.
No, of course. Yeah. So it's like, you can make those points, but you have to realize that, you don't have anybody co-signing. I did Blazing Saddles on stage once, and there was a scene for a moment, there was a possibility that we were not going to have a black actor to play the lead. And I'm like, nope, won't do it if that's going to happen. And they're like, no, we weren't serious. I'm like, okay, good. I'm glad you weren't serious because you freaked me out. You cannot have somebody not co-signing if we're saying the N-word on stage 30 times or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
The point's lost completely.
Yeah.
Again, like you say, you can push the line, but you've got to know.
I think it's smart just not to go there.
Yeah. Yeah. There are other ways to make your joke.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah, so, I hadn't listened to this garden in 20 years or something, and when that came up, I was like, oh, God, why did I pick this record? And the horrible thing is that the tune is so catchy.
Of course it is.
You know, and on one level, in 1980, they're making this joke, and it's sort of funny, and it's Monty Python, and obviously, the liberal progressive mentality and everything, and that's fine, but what the unintended consequence is that you now have a 12-year-old boy running around on his bicycle singing this stuff at the top of his lungs.
Yeah.
And that is not cool.
No. Yeah. Do you have a favorite song off of this entire album?
There is the only reason everybody should own this record is track number 11, Traffic Lights. Which
I love that you picked that one.
Is a sublime moment in comedy that is just groundbreaking and fresh, and like it's nothing they've done before.
Yeah,
and that I know of. I mean, I don't know everything Monty Python had done.
Sure,
this morose, depressed person singing this lugubrious song that just, you know, just goes on and on and on, and then the chorus comes in of these like, deflated people, and he just gives up. But I like traffic lights. I like traffic lights. I like traffic. I don't know how many times he goes, but only when they're green. He likes traffic lights, and it sort of breaks. It pushes a boundary for me in that, if people aren't laughing when you start something, just repeating it is not going to make them laugh.
Right, right.
Unless it's this song.
Unless it's this song.
Because the more it does it, the more... Because you start listening to it, what the hell is this? This is not... Oh, my God.
Yeah.
But it just goes on and on and on. And then he gets to, even though my name's not Bamba. But then he's like, how the hell is he going to have something that rhymes with that? You know, obviously it's, you know, well, maybe the joke is a little bit lost here because, you know, you don't
we
say...
We would say yellow here.
You say yellow, say not amber. Amber.
Right. That, yeah, and actually I think that took me several years to get what the hell he was going for. until like, oh, right, a little bit of logic. Just a quick sidestep. But, oh, I love that. And he starts cracking, too. Like, there's a lot of cracking, which, again, shouldn't work. But, no, that's a really good song.
It's just, it's such a bold and simple idea as well. And it just, you know, it just really stands out. And it's funny. And it's like, when you can't explain it. It just works. For me, I don't know. Maybe some people just think it's stupid. But
it seems like one, too, that where you will know who your friends are immediately if you sit down and this is the track you pick. If that person's like, what the hell are you playing for me? And you're like, you don't get me. That's fine. Yeah, exactly. You can leave. This is, you have to. And that's one of those songs I know my best friend and I listen to over and over.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, God, I'm so glad to hear you say that.
It's a delight. I mean, if you don't like, I mean, again, it's one of the, I'm So Worried on here. It is, right?
Yeah.
Yes. That's one that's similar, but it also, that is torture for me to listen to, but I also love it.
Yeah.
It's pure torture.
Oh, and the Here Comes Another One is... Oh, God. Genius.
Uh-huh.
Here comes another one.
And his nose is getting plugged towards the end of it. It's so upsetting.
Yeah.
And again, there's so much on here that is like, let's see what we can do to fuck with the audience. And they do that more on their albums than anybody, I feel.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like they're having fun with the stuff they were creating just for this record. I mean, I don't know, you know, necessarily. I think those must be originals for the record, but
I'm assuming most of the songs are, and just the sketches that were recycled. I could be wrong, and somebody will pick on me for that, but I love that there's sketches that nobody's heard, you know, nobody was watching it last in 1948. I'm surprised that even exists. I think there are still copies of some of those.
Are there any?
Yes, I think you can get them on Amazon, but I don't know. Again, I don't know how they survived since they almost wiped all the Monty Python tapes at one point. I think Terry Gilliam had to buy them all to save them.
Oh, that's right. They were going to... Oh, the BBC is so stupid.
Yeah, that's how they killed... I mean, there's a solid half a season or full season or a few seasons of Doctor Who that are not...
Oh, the early ones, yeah.
Yeah, just gone. Just goes... That's insane to me. We need to recycle these tapes. Come on. We've got to, you know, put more Two Ronnies on the air. What are you going to do? I enjoy the Two Ronnies. I actually really like that album. If it's the same one that you have, then I
like watching their Christmas specials. They're Morecambe and Wise.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
They're fun. Yeah.
Did you... That's not a thing we had that I... Not too much over here. We're like, you can get... Let's see, from the 70s, there's a couple All in the Family albums, but they're compilations, not full episodes. In which case, I also have an album that is, what's the English show All in the Family was based off of?
That's Alf Garner, isn't it?
With Una Stubbs.
Till Death Us Do Part.
Thank you, yes. Yeah. And so they did one of those, and I have that. So it's kind of fun to compare to listen to those two.
Yeah.
Those two, I actually kind of like the English version better. As much as All in the Family is a brilliant show. Yeah, it's not a thing they did over here. But the BBC, you can still buy just tons of these shows.
Yeah, and now they're on. You can just look them up on YouTube. And,
right.
And there they are.
Actually see full episodes and things.
Yeah.
Did you... So of what's in that pile, we'll get back to this, but of what's in that pile, like how much of this stuff have you had since you were a kid?
I was just listening to this. Mm-hmm. You ever come up with the other...
Yes.
Seen these guys?
Not the 9 o'clock news. And no. I think this is the first one we did of theirs on the show.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Talking about racism.
Holy cow. Like, holy cow.
I just started listening to it and I was like, oh my God, I can't have this playing here. This is awful. So, yeah. There was that. I loved that show when it came out.
Mm-hmm. A lot of those sketches are brilliant. I mean, they are record. Really good, but...
there's Hoffman, which we did.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a bunch of these sort of compilation... We Are Most Amused. They would sort of bring these out at Christmas. And this one is for... You can... they can contribute to the Prince's Trust there.
So that has...
Jasper Carrot and Max Boyce and Alan Bennett, Fawlty Towers, The Goons. So, you know, this is BBC just raiding their back catalog. it's one of my dad's records.
There's so much on here.
There's another one.
Is that the other?
Oh, we got Tony Hancock.
Oh, the last.
Has anyone ever done him?
No. I feel like he's been brought up, but I don't think I even know Tony Hancock other than maybe having seen him in a few things, but not his actual.
This is the Blood Donor and the Radio Ham. They were like these. Those are the classics.
Mm-hmm.
I've got. He's a big influence on my Noel Coward.
Mm-hmm.
Live at Las Vegas.
I've never heard that album either.
Nah, there's another. There's more Noel Coward. These must be my grannies. Oh, there's the two Ronnies.
Okay, I've not seen that one. See, now I've just got you showing me different records that you own, but it's fun for me.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I don't know what that's. Half of them are missing. I was looking for them this morning.
Mm-hmm. So you picked this album up at 14, which is the perfect age for this kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But you had the LP. Did you put it on a cassette? I'm always curious how people... Did you bring it
with you to school? Oh, yeah, I would put everything... Yeah, because I was probably taking it to school, so I'd have to put it onto a cassette. And I'd swap cassettes with my, you know, with my friend who was into it.
So yeah. He would, that's so much fun.
So I'd give him the contractual, I think as I pronounced it, the contractional obligation album. And he'd give me Drury Lane and whatever. But yeah, that's pretty much how we listen to them.
Besides the stuff that now strikes you as, oh, that's terribly inappropriate, are there jokes that you're either just getting now or took you years to get that were too adult?
I mean, I don't think, you know, when it was funny watching Life of Brian and watching them take pot shots at religion, because, like I said, being forced to go to church every Sunday and, you know, it was nice to see someone sticking two fingers up to, you know, not to Jesus or,
sure.
You know, like, but to the pomposity of the organization,
sure.
Of religion. I think on this, like, the running joke they have in a couple of sketches about the bishops, that they're really trying to get bishops to do, to do radio commercials. They say, can we get the Bishop of Bath and Wells? Oh, Bath and Wells. Oh, yes, he's so good, isn't he? Why are we stuck with the Bishop of Carlisle? I don't know. He's like, I think that's, you know, I think. Being more mature now, I can sort of see how they, they were very intentionally taking a pot shots at it, and not necessarily so much on this record, but
right.
You know, how they would, with the TV show, really they were sort of anti-establishment, mm-hmm. in a way that is, I imagine, was very unsettling to the Brits at the time, especially mm-hmm. people, like you said, people of their own generation, because they were the product that was supposed to be the establishment. They were Oxbridge, yeah. educated, you know, upper middle class men, white men.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're the sort of people that should be, you know, doing arts programs on the BBC and,
sure.
You know, documentaries about, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd watch something that was in that format, and then they just like blow it up and lampoon it, especially the format of television, how the BBC, which was, you know, back then, I mean, I guess maybe it is still a little bit, I haven't really lived there for a while, you know, this sort of nice kind of comforting nanny-ish authority figure,
yeah,
like the imposing but comforting at the same time, and so
right.
by playing around with the tropes of television and you know, spoofing it, and that they were you know, really quite subversive in a way that I think was probably quite uncomfortable
sure.
to people.
Yeah, because TV's been around 20 years or so when it started technically. Yeah. And if you, as you say, if you've only got two channels, you're going to feel like you're a bit in prison. So of course you're going to go to darts. Why would you stick around to the thing that's challenging everything you understand about the world?
Yes. Yeah, and they would take pot shots at class, like the upper class tour of the year. And, you know, and the sort of twee middle class, you know, sensibilities and, you know, the... Wasn't there a party where the couple are trying to... You know, nice middle class couple are trying to get it on, and the Terry John Cleese arrives with his wife, and she needs beans. She has some beans, and then they invite all their friends around, and you know, the way they would mock that in a, you know, not necessarily friendly way,
right?
Was subversive is really the only word. So I don't think as a kid I was aware that they were subversive. Sure. I was drawn to the silliness.
Well, it's perfect too, because they're coming from, like so many comedy greats, they're coming from the Footlights and things like that. Great. But then they go through this, they're working with David Frost, but they're also working on children's television. Did Not Adjust Your Set was quote unquote for children, but then... And I think because of that sensibility, they learned, oh, you can do anything in this format, it feels like. And then Monty Python feels like a children's show for grown-ups. It 100% does.
Yes, and especially with the animation and everything.
It's, yeah.
Do Not Adjust Your Set. That didn't have that. Have Tim Brooke Taylor and
Bill I know Oddie. Specifically Eric Idle and Michael Palin and the Bonzo Dog Doodoo Band. That's all I know.
Because some of those guys had a show called the Goodies.
Okay.
Which is hilarious and absurdist in the same way that Monty Python is, but it is absolutely intended for children.
Really? I love it. Okay.
So, I'd
love
to hunt that one out too. You can find it on YouTube. Check it out. It's really, I still find it funny, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, we used to watch that religiously. Yeah, so Monty Python, you know, some of them split off, went to Monty Python, then the other guys went and did the Goodies.
So interesting to me. I just love that they... Yeah, the idea also of anybody being beyond the racial stuff, being that offended by just their mere existence is very funny to me, because it's a world I've never lived in, so I can't imagine seeing your parents just so upset by it. That's so funny to me. And repeats, no less, right? Occasional repeats, you would have to have seen them?
I think they would have been on repeat, because they screened through 74 or something?
I think so, yeah.
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 So either I was watching the last, you know, I only have a memory of seeing a snippet of one show.
Okay.
Until I came to America.
Sure, sure. You
know, I could watch it on PBS. The BBC, maybe the BBC had a funny relationship as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
That's so funny.
I'd have to read about that.
Were there, I don't know if we've talked about this before, I'm just curious what, if any, American comedy influences you had at the time were, and where they came from, if they were primarily...
Well, I love Mel Brooks. I mean, sure. He's amazing. Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein. And, what other Americans? Steve Martin.
Yeah.
Although I didn't know that he had records and stuff like that. I mean, I knew him through his movies.
Sure.
I really like watching sitcoms. So, you know, I'd watch Cheers and all that kind of stuff. There was, who's that guy? He was amazing. Bill Hicks.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when I was a little bit older. You know, sure. Listening, you know, he goes beyond stand-up and he's preaching something there.
I'm actually shocked we've never talked about him on the show, because I really want to get into it. And I also want to see if I would still love it as much. But
right.
He's so intense.
As I understand it, he's not even that well known in the
Not US. Like, I mean, and I know he had to be, he did do some stuff over in England. I keep forgetting that. But yeah, he's still like a cult figure. Like really, if you're into comedy and you're in comedy, if you don't know who Bill Hicks is, that's a huge mistake. But yeah, not famous, no. Because if I were to go to like a general audience and say, you guys interested in me talking about Bill Hicks, they'd be like, there might be people who don't know who the hell that is. What was his presence over there? Did he come over and just do stand-up or...
Yeah, you'd see, I mean, like a stand-up special. Or okay. There was a show, I don't know if he was on that particularly, but there was a show that I'd watch every week called Saturday Night Live, obviously based after Saturday Night Live in the US, but nothing like it in that it was really... Well, I mean, there were some sketches and stuff, but there was quite a bit of stand-up in it, too.
Interesting, okay.
And then they got... Then Channel 4 or whoever was running it moved it to Friday, so they had to call it Friday Night Live, and that was like, what? Maybe it was on that as a guest or something. I can't remember exactly how, but I remember just seeing it and go, whoa, that's really something.
It's intense. I think his material, too, he wasn't a guy who would change it much, so I think it would fly with slightly looser censorship.
Yeah.
So not over here, you know, at least at the time, because there wasn't much. I think all of his specials were on cable, so you could only get it if you had HBO or Showtime, if I remember correctly. And, yeah, I didn't discover him till college, till I, you know, learned to steal MP3s and stuff. And
thought
that was the smartest thing in the world. Dumb, dumb, dumb. Actually, I learned so much about comedy, I got a lot of influences figured out at that point. And then later on, you go to buy the albums if you're a good little boy. Yeah, that's interesting. Bill Hicks.
Yeah, but we couldn't, we didn't, beyond seeing stuff like Animal House and the Blues Brothers, mm-hmm. you know, the movies and stuff, they didn't screen... Saturday Night Live, the American version. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really, I mean, I'd read about it and heard about it,
sure.
but didn't really know exactly what it was until I started living over here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a huge amount of American influences, although now I'm really into, silent film stars.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, who specifically?
Well, Charlie Chaplin, obviously.
And sure.
Harold Lloyd. Buster Keaton, mm-hmm. the obvious ones.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. a couple months ago, we had on Paul Dooley, who's a brilliant actor and who's met Buster Keaton. He's old enough to have met Buster Keaton. Yeah, I think he's got a photo of himself with him somewhere in his house. Also heavily influenced by... That's interesting, you're coming to it later, this late, though. You know, like, you've been performing for so long, and now you're like, oh, I'm interested in silent film stars.
Well, I do it very specifically to rip them off.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
Why would you not? I mean, you've got to be seen from a distance.
I'm surprised more people aren't. I mean, that stuff is genius.
Mm-hmm.
When we're doing plays in the park, where you have to put in a certain amount of physical comedy into them, and, those are the go-to guys, mm-hmm. you know? And I suppose I sort of... When I started studying Peter Sellers a little bit more and realizing that he was using them as an influence.
Sure.
That's when I started exploring them a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And Monty Python, I had a big sort of Monty Python phase. And then when I went to a different school, a really nice housemaster who had a great record collection, and he'd let me just rifle through it. And, he said, yeah, Monty Python's great, but you really need to start listening to the people that came before them, like Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. And,
yeah, oh my God. Yeah. Wait, did he have Derek and Clive for you to listen to? Because that seems...
I think I bought a Derek and Clive record once.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. As a child, 12-year-old or whatever. Oh. And I think I had to take it back. Because I couldn't. I think I bought it when I was at that school.
Mm-hmm.
No, so maybe I was a little bit older, mm-hmm. like 13 or 14. But he wouldn't let me play it because it was. And then I thought, well, if I can't play it here, I definitely can't play it in front of my parents.
Yeah,
so
right.
I think I took it back and got something else. I think it came in a brown paper bag or something. It was.
That's amazing.
But no, the clean. He had the Pete and Dud stuff.
Okay.
Which is really clever. I couldn't really see their TV shows, but they did a couple of movies. They did Bedazzled, which
I've
seen that. Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
There's an entire album also, speaking of which, that is their promos for Bedazzled and them improvising while they're recording their promos for Bedazzled.
Really?
Yes, I'll have to hunt that down.
Oh my God, I'd love to.
I have a friend who cleaned that up and the artwork for it. He does that as a hobby.
Why the hell did they remake that? I haven't seen it, but I can't imagine.
I don't know. And it's also...
Steve Martin's great, but
sure.
I've not seen him play Inspector Clouseau, and I have no appetite for it whatsoever.
No.
I mean, that's just sacred.
Yeah.
Although there was an American actor that played him.
Is there? Before the pink?
Oh, God, what's his name? He's really famous.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, the Peter Sellers did a couple of Pink Panther movies, mm-hmm. and then either wasn't available or whatever, and so the
they Why don't had I know this?
What's his name?
Because all I can think of right now is when Roberto Benigni played the son of the Pink Panther.
Oh God, did he?
Yes.
Yeah.
That was like I want to say like was it would have been right before Life is Beautiful. So it was, I think it was like the early to mid 90s. It was like the only he broke here. You're right. Alan Arkin played
him. Alan Arkin, that's it, yeah.
Alan Arkin played him, right. There's a lot of people who played him, actually, in varying things. But yeah, Alan Arkin, I'd forgotten about that. That's yeah. a weird choice. I mean, he's a great actor. And good friends with friend of the show, Paul Dooley. That's really weird to me. Well, you know, at some point, we're going to have to save Sellers, because I would sit and talk to you about Sellers,
well,
too,
I was curious. Trying to, I have a Peter Sellers record.
Mm-hmm.
It's not great.
Yeah.
But, I couldn't find it this morning.
Does that album have, because I don't know where this is from, the She Loves You thing where he does different riffs on She Loves You?
He does it as Laurence Olivier, mm-hmm. Laurence Olivier's Richard III performing She Loves You. No, it's A Hard Day's Night.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's been a hard day's night, mm-hmm. and I've been sleeping like a dog.
So I think he must do both of those songs then, because I know he also does She Loves You, yeah. and that also with the German.
No,
but
it's
then
before
a couple
that.
Of
it's
Irish
it's,
guys
it's
in the
actually
pub.
Quite an early one.
That's interesting, okay.
And a lot of the sketches are not actually even by him, so.
Weird.
Yeah, some of them are quite funny.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, so he had such a wide-ranging career, especially in the, mm-hmm. you know, in the 50s. You can't forget that he had this big film career even before Pink Panther and
right.
everything. That, you know, he was this mercurial actor that could do pretty much anything.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever listen to The Goons? I mean, were you forced to, or did
well,
you?
Well, that was one of the things. John Atkinson, my housemaster, he pointed me in the direction of The Goons
okay.
as well. And I did, when I was cleaning out everything for my dad, he had all of The Goon shows on cassette, and I don't
know, oh
I just threw them away. Because you have to do that mm-hmm. You have to pick things really quickly, especially when you live on yeah. the other side of the planet.
Of course.
And you've got someone who's expecting to move into the house.
Yeah, yeah.
So I saved one just, but I, you know, I just figured you could probably listen to it on, and I they weren't part of my childhood or anything.
Right,
but,
right.
You know,
they're all out there.
I think they went to the charity shop.
Well, there you go. Some nerd is going to be very happy about that.
Yeah.
Listening to the same voice. I will tell you, like, that, it doesn't have any nostalgia for me, but when I first listened to it, I'm like, oh, this is great. Like, I don't understand everything that's happening. It's so frenetic.
Yeah.
It's insane. And you can understand the influence here, but even Python feels toned down in terms of the energy.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I suppose they had to because it was all on radio and,
mm-hmm.
and they had these crazy voices. And I suppose if you were following it, you knew who all the characters were. And
yes,
and
that's the thing I think that throws you most.
Yeah. The Beatles were really into The Goons. You know,
yeah,
John
that
Lennon
doesn't
would
surprise
do
me
of,
at
you know,
all.
What was the character? Blue Bottle, I guess his name was. I'm not going to attempt an impression because I have to perform Titus tonight. And it might ruin my throat.
All right. And I definitely won't. Try because that's not you don't let the Englishman not do it first. Oh man, see, now I almost went off on a tangent on Neil Innes because of the Beatles, because I was just rewatching the Ruddles, and there's nobody who does a better John Lennon impression than Neil Innes.
Oh yeah,
holy crap, because yeah. he does a bit in, and I'm so sorry to people to do this, but like he does a bit in it where he's just doing John Lennon, his character Ron Nasty, who's just making a joke. And then does that thing where after he smiles, he just stops dead. And I'm like, nobody else couldn't, which is just a John Lennon thing he would do, where he'd like, yeah. I'll make a joke and then stare at the camera. And it just nails it perfectly. Sorry, it's on
well,
my mind.
John Lennon was part of that world, wasn't
yeah.
he? I mean, they knew him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He tells a story, or some of the guys from Bonzo Dog Band tell a story, because they're in Magical Mystery Tour performing one of their damn songs. And apparently John Lennon had no interest in them being there. One of them was like, yeah, he's just up his own ass, because like that's just who John Lennon was. But he also got comedy, but he just did seem to be very self-important. But it's weird to me. It's interesting. I thought he was a funny guy.
John
yeah.
Lennon? Yeah, I mean, I think he changed day by day. Mm-hmm. I think he was out there and
yeah.
dealing with being a famous, mm-hmm. the most famous person on the planet, which...
Right.
Probably not very easy. You should cut him some slack, really.
Yeah, maybe.
My dad's on a Beatles record.
What?
Yeah.
Which one?
Hey Jude, number one when I was born.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
Playing.
Well, that was the thing. This has nothing to do with Monty Python.
I don't care. It's fine. We can get distracted for a minute.
All my life, the story that he told was that he was, because he was the trumpet player in the London Symphony Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And, they recorded at Abbey Road there with EMI and everything as well. So a lot of them would do session work with the Beatles. And I think he said he was on a number of records, but, he just didn't know what they were because he'd just go in and blow a note or whatever. But with Hey Jude, he said they got there in the morning quite early for this session and the Beatles were still figuring it out.
Uh-huh.
And so they were just waiting around, and some of them that were booked from the LSO had a lunchtime concert, so they had to go and do this concert. So his story was always when he got back, they'd done, I think it's those orchestral sort of, big power chords.
And, mm-hmm.
I think they did it pretty quickly, so it was done.
Yeah.
So his story was always how he never actually played on Hey Jude. And a few years before he died, I said, because I'm such a Beatles nut now, I said, what was it like? I know you didn't play on it, but what was the day like? Mm-hmm. Did you see them? He goes, yeah, they were there. We saw them quite often. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, just tell me, what happened? He goes, the funny thing was that I got paid three times. Why? Because he's in the Musicians Union. Mm-hmm. He said, I got paid for as an instrumentalist. I didn't play. But I also got paid for percussion and as a vocalist. And why? Because, because when I got back, we had to clap our hands and sing Na 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 Na. And I went, what? You kidding me? You sang on a Beatles record? And you...
the most memorable nonsense lyric in pop history.
And, I think for him, that was, the fact that he didn't get to play his trumpet was, that was the end of it. I think he said one of the guys said, I'm not singing on McCartney's bloody record and stormed out. because they were all proper classical musicians.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
I guess, some of them didn't get it so much. But
wow.
Yeah. So that was his Beatles story.
That's
and his
remarkable.
Other one, is, he topped that with his Star Wars story.
What?
So Star Wars, the London Symphony Orchestra did all the Star Wars
mm-hmm,
movies.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're on the new ones, but everything else. So he's looking at the calendar for 1976,
mm-hmm.
and he sees it blocked it out for this thing that he misread as Star Awards. So he said, I'm not working on a bloody award show for a whole month. Uh-huh. So he took a vacation and got his... They got the guy from the Philharmonic to do it.
Oh my God.
I think he's on some of it, but not as much as...
Does there have a chance he could have been the opening? Because holy crap, that's amazing.
Well, that was his mate, Morris Murphy, was the principal trumpet, and that was actually his first day on the job as the principal trumpet of the LSO was playing that, that trumpet fanfare at the beginning of Star Wars. That's
you're joking.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Holy shit. Wow. I mean, that's the unassuming nature of a working artist of any kind, I feel like. There are times when you just do a thing where it's like somebody else is going to be totally blown away that you were an extra in this if you're an actor, or you had one line on a show that you didn't give a shit about, That happens all the time.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to meet somebody who's like, you're fucking kidding. That's my favorite thing. I have that all the time. I have a podcast about news radio and people are so shocked, which is a show you may have never seen or even heard of. I
remember
know.
That show, yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
No English people know the show.
Yeah.
But you were probably here when it was on
air.
Okay,
yeah.
So there we go. And it's my favorite sitcom. People get their, why do you care that I was on this show? Like, you don't understand. It changed my life. it's huge.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so funny to me. That's amazing.
Yeah, and one of his mates, actually, to bring this back to Monty Python.
Sure, sure.
His best friend, Mike McNaught, actually did arranging for some of Monty Python. He did, he worked on that movie, The Meaning of Life.
Yeah.
And I meant to bring it in today. It's because Mike... gave me his copy of the script.
Oh my God.
And it has Terry Jones's telephone number scribbled on
the
front.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Oh, that's so good.
I still have that somewhere. And I was so proud to get that because I had it before the movie came out.
Of course.
Get together with my friends and we'd act out sketches and stuff. So we all knew the movie when when it came out.
Did you try and call his number? Because I would have.
No.
No. Damn.
No, maybe. I didn't even think about it. It didn't even occur to me.
Should have.
That's, yeah, well, I lack that American go-to spirit, you know. Well, that's what being British is all about, knowing your place, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is why it's refreshing to live over here.
Okay, let us get back, because I apologize. I did sidetrack us with all kinds of different talk. But do you have a favorite track on here? I mean, you said Traffic Light's your favorite song. Is that remain your favorite track on the whole thing as well?
I'd say that's my... Yes, that okay. would be my favorite track.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the one... Is it the Martyrdom of St. Victor? The
yes.
one with the hand that drives the...
Uh-huh.
The mighty, it's the power, all about the power of God.
Yes.
And this is the force that created the world. And this is the power that drives the hand, the drink's treadmill.
Yes.
the great lager with the mighty taste of fish. Oops, sorry.
Oops, sorry. Over and over.
I think it's a bishop doing it. is it that? Or
is oh, that wait, the name no. Of the, oh, no. May, are they two different ones? Because it did sound very much like they were the same, but... Now
no, no, no. It's I can't remember the name of the sketch, but uh-huh. it's that one.
Anyway, it's very funny.
Yeah, so yeah, probably that one.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Bishop? That's what it was.
Oh, yes. Bishop. Okay, there we are. Simple enough.
But yeah, it's an interesting sort of mixed bag of mm-hmm. some really great stuff and then some, you know, some all things dull and ugly, which is... It's you know I think I would always skip it mm-hmm. when I was listening to it as
even
a
though
person.
Even though it was one of those the religion ones it
well
didn't...
This is listening to it now it's like oh I you know I get what that's about
okay
you know if you're gonna say all creatures great and small everything's bright and beautiful mm-hmm. and it's like they're not mm-hmm. not everything's bright and beautiful mm-hmm. some things like, want to fucking kill you and God made that too
yeah
let's not forget that so that sort of appeals to me now
yeah
whereas before I think I didn't really get it.
Yeah.
Muddy Knees, I'm not so mad about.
Uh-huh.
Right.
It was a very weird gospel song for no reason.
Yeah.
That's very strange. You know, there's a on YouTube, if you look the album up on YouTube, it'll play track by track with annoying ads in between. But there is an ad for this that I do think the ad is, I think it's unintentional. So John Cleese is just reading, just saying, you know, you should listen to this album, blah, 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 blah. It's 33 seconds, and he gets the name of the album wrong in the first five, but I don't think it's a joke. I don't think it's on purpose. He just calls it the Contractual Album and then calls it the Contractual Obligation Album 15 seconds later. I literally think they were that lazy about it. I could
really?
Be wrong.
Yeah.
I'd like to get him on mic to find out. But
yeah.
Yeah, that is how little... Like, I mean, the joke is we didn't put that much effort into it, but also... There are some sketches that imply maybe you didn't. It's so hard to tell. There's so much work put into some of the songs.
The secret of great comedy is mm-hmm. honesty
yeah.
and this thing that we call truth.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the more something rings as true, the more it's funny. So whenever they're doing this stuff, like it's a rip-off, yeah, we're ripping off, you know,
mm-hmm.
here's my divorce payment tour or whatever.
Right.
They're actually... You know, there's truth in that.
Yeah.
You know, that is actually why they're doing it.
Yeah.
And the fact that they're being honest about it is sort of funny and refreshing.
For sure.
So, yeah, I suppose as a young person, I had no idea why it was called the Contractual Obligation Album, not
sure.
really understanding what a record deal was
yeah.
or anything. But yeah, it does, you know, it does feel a little bit like a sort of a throwaway. But interestingly, it's their highest charting album.
That's so weird.
Yeah.
I mean, it's great. I there's so much... based on the idea that, again, if there was less effort put into it, whatever, that's impressive. And the fact that there are any... That there are such... I mean, again, the sketch that has influenced me the most from the first time I heard it is on here. So I could never completely discount this album.
Right.
Even if that was the only good one on it. And it's not. There's plenty of very
yeah.
good stuff on here. So
yeah.
much good music. I actually really like the Henry Kissinger song. I've always really liked that one.
Yeah, that's funny.
It's so stupid, but I delight in it. Have you ever seen them live? Have you ever had the opportunity to see them live?
No.
Yeah. I almost did. I almost got to see them at the O2, but that did not happen. I'm so upset. That was supposed to happen. Would have been the last time I'd be able to see them while the remaining guys together, since Terry Jones doesn't perform anymore.
Yeah.
So
that's
sad.
Sad, isn't it?
It is.
Sad about Graham Chapman as well.
Mm-hmm.
He was kind of the genius.
You know, I know.
Crazy genius.
I know. Have you ever seen... I feel like they show outtakes from Holy Grail where He's just lying between every, because he was so off his ass drunk. He would just read the lines perfectly and in ways we all now repeat and remember, but then just like just had to ask for every other line. Yelling up to the castle. It's insane to me.
I did this movie called Ironclad.
Uh-huh.
Which is about the siege of Rochester Castle in 1215, with Paul Giamatti playing King John.
Interesting.
I arrived on the set for the first day. I play a character, the Baron Darnay, who has a castle that King John sieges as the opening 10 minutes of the movie is all about that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I get strung up. And I was supposed to be trampled to death by a horse, but they ran out of light, and I had to travel back to LA the next day. So so my death was indeterminate.
Oh my god!
I got there for the first day of shooting, and I watched them shoot the first scene in the morning, and it literally was a bunch of people on horseback going up to the front of this Norman castle, and this guard pops over the parapet with one of those hats and goes, "Who goes there?" or something like that. And it was just, no one else get the reference here. It was just like the scene in Monty Python.
That's amazing. Wait, now you're now. Does Paul Giamatti do an English accent in this then?
He does, yeah.
How is it? Or are you not allowed to say?
It's pretty good.
Yeah?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That surprises me.
Really?
Yes. He doesn't strike me as an accent guy. I think he's a great actor. He's unfortunately the one actor people say I look like. Thanks, people, for that. But, yeah, that's weird. I didn't expect... All right.
Yeah, no.
Well, I mean, since you're in it, I'll look it up.
Yeah,
anyway,
I mean, I don't recall ever being thrown by it.
Okay.
Most of my scenes were with him as well.
Mm-hmm.
And,
that's awesome.
Yeah, it was weird because... I don't do a whole lot of movie work.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of don't know what another actor is going to be like. And there's a sort of modern actor that they use the lavalier microphone, as a tool.
Oh, sure, sure.
Talk like this.
Yeah.
Because they know that it's going to come out as really sort of rumbling and sort of whispering and intense.
Mm-hmm.
And, if you're standing, 10 feet away, you can't actually hear what they're saying. So they're talking at a subhuman level. And so we do the scene, and Paul is up on a horse. It's very Monty Python-ish, apart from there's actually a horse. And I'm sort of in the mud begging for my life. And it's the rehearsal, as he sort of, shook his head or something, and I'm like, "God, did he say his line? Is he a whispery actor?" Oh. I'm like, "Oh fuck, no." And then I said my line, and he got really mad. Oh, and then he spoke, and he was like, "Oh, he's a proper actor. he's got a real voice." it was embarrassing.
If only it were the early days of the talkies when you had to yell to the microphone.
I think there's a real power in people having to actually use their voices, mm-hmm. Because you get a performance in that. So having that microphone up there, I think there's a who is that guy that George Clooney always works with? He did a movie, The Good German, I think it was, that they...
Steven Soderbergh?
Yeah, Steven Soderbergh, mm-hmm. So where they actually put a microphone there, so people would have to project.
Okay.
That's what we do in the park as well. We don't use the lavaliers, we just have floor mics.
Right.
So you have to give it a signal, and then that is part of the performance.
Sure.
Was Monty Python shot in front of... It wasn't shot in front of an audience, was it, some of that stuff?
I am not 100%. I feel like it had to have been played to an audience because of all the animation and stuff. I don't think I did anything live.
Right.
I don't think. There are going to be Monty Python fans who are annoyed with me for not knowing, but I'm not 100%. But
they have a stage sensibility in the way they perform.
Yes,
that isn't TV acting. It's mm-hmm. it's they're conscious of an audience
right.
in a way.
Right.
You were asking, how I'm influenced by them, but their delivery and their timing and musicality and their ability to land and communicate in that way, they're out of the music hall tradition in a way, mm-hmm. So they still have an idea about the stage,
right?
And that's where they come from, because the Cambridge Footlights, and the stuff they did after that, is all you know, that was all stage stuff. And they toured a little bit as well, didn't they?
They must have.
Yeah.
Because there were always Footlights touring shows, and then there were, because Beyond the Fringe, I think, was based off of a, I could be wrong. I feel like it was based off of a university show of some kind.
Right.
So it wasn't entirely unusual.
I really wanted, I after I went to the school I went to when I was 13, and I met the housemaster who sort of like helped me sort of develop my comedy tastes, I decided that that was for me, that I absolutely had to go to Cambridge so I could be in the Footlights. Not because I wanted a degree from Cambridge, but I just wanted to be in the Footlights, and that was going to be how my career was going to go. And he was such a sweet man. At one point he said, you know, David, to get into Cambridge, you really actually have to be quite a good student. Maybe this isn't for you.
Oh, my God.
I was deemed too stupid to go to university, and indeed I didn't.
Holy shit, that's so funny. That's amazing. Do you keep in touch with this teacher? Is he still alive?
You know, I hadn't spoken to him for a long time, and then he was visiting family over here, and he came to the show.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And it was Two Gents, which I directed, so there was a lot of my sort of, influence in, a lot of the influences that he would have given to me was sort of in that show. So I was really, really chuffed that he came to see that.
That's amazing.
He sent me a really sweet email, and he said the night after they went to the Comedy Store, and he said he couldn't understand why, because it's so blue and so shocking and so graphic, and he just didn't, it's just not funny.
Yeah.
I don't know why people feel that they have to be that.
Right.
Aggressively, and it's not shocking anymore that talk about your naughty parts and to swear, and just to try to be as disgusting as possible. It's just that's not funny.
I would watch you do stand up if you referred to them as your naughty parts, though. That would be the funniest thing on the planet to me. You got up as an Englishman doing that 100%.
I am tempted to do it. I'm sort of terrified of the idea of doing it. I've never
me
done
too.
Stand-up.
Me neither. Yeah, no, that's scary to me.
And I have a friend who does it, and he's really good, my friend Dave, and he's always trying to get me to go and do it.
Really?
Maybe once I would do it. I can't imagine what that life is like, though. You've got like 4 or 5 minutes, and you've got to make it work in that. I mean, if I go and do the show tonight and I screw up the first 20 minutes, I've still got, 2 hours to right the ship and turn it around.
Yeah.
But,
good God. Yeah. I hadn't thought about it in that way. Yeah. Thing about stand up, though, means at least some people say you get by in presence. You can get by on presence if you got one or two good jokes and you really know how to sell them.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that.
Maybe.
I can see that. I just,
I don't know how common that is, though.
I think it's the celebrity stand-up people, will say that they get a free pass for the first 2 minutes or something. They'll laugh at anything they say, but then after that, you actually kind of have to be funny.
Right.
I don't know. I wouldn't. I mean, I think whatever if I did it, whatever I did would be so beyond. I mean, so not what would be going before or after me.
Cause
I have, I'm a Shakespearean actor. I'm not a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
I'd
be curious what your first instincts were to do as a joke. If you ever do it, I need to see you do stand up.
I'd actually like to try and do a sort of quasi George Formby routine with, write some funny songs.
That'd be great.
Having just admonished everybody for being too rude, all the George Formby songs are about double entendres, but I'd like to write some songs that are supposed to be double entendres, but then they just become entendres.
That I like. Yeah. Well, because you're playing with the form. That's fine.
People don't know the form anymore, though, so it probably wouldn't work. What the hell is this person doing? Why is he pretending to be from World War II?
Okay, let's do this. Let's do the thing we always do at the end. Why listen to this album?
They hadn't made a studio album since 1974.
Right.
Yeah, because the other ones are live albums or outtakes from TV or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Right? Or recreations of the sketches from the show, yeah.
So, I mean, Traffic Lights is the reason to listen to this.
Yeah.
and it's there's some comedy genius in there, you know, and it's such a sort of smorgasbord and a variety, and it's got great songs, and some, you know, it's, and now Monty Python, you know, is like meeting a, you know, an old friend or your big mm-hmm. brother or something like that. I mean, yeah. I don't mean like Orwell's big brother. I mean your actual sibling who you look up to.
That's perfect. And I can recommend it specifically for Rock Notes. Which is, I absolutely love. And then the whole bookstore sketch is stupid, but if you like a funny voice, if you like a mouthful of words, like, do you have 7 days in the Samarkand desert with the Duchess of Kent by A.J. Eliot, OBE? It's so good. It's so dumb. So dumb. But I know some nerds who have that entire sketch memorized, like, word for word.
Yeah, that's pretty brilliant, isn't
it? Yeah, it's great.
But Charles Dickens. Charles Dickens with two Ks?
With two Ks, the well-known Dutch author.
Nicholas Nickleby. That's K-N-I-C-K.
No. Is it? He says, is it, so many times in so many sketches. Like, it's his weird catchphrase that he's like, somebody just insists something's true. Is it? I love John Cleese is authoritarian, and that's what he makes his money on. I mean, that's yeah. his bit. That's great.
It's interesting. I mean, this is sort of them more or less without him, though.
Yeah, that's the only one that I can even think of him being on.
Yeah, might and be he wasn't really one. There for the last season of the TV show.
Right,
was he?
Right. He left for that.
Yeah.
Neil Innes wrote a sketch in that season, which I did not know until today.
Oh,
I
really?
Had to study. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Only two people were credited with writing sketches besides the Pythons: him and Douglas Adams. Neil Innes and Douglas Adams. Yeah, which I didn't know about Douglas Adams until I read that.
My housemaster, I keep talking about, he was at Cambridge with Douglas Adams.
What?
Yeah.
Holy
so God. He was, yeah, he was actually in the Footlights.
That's amazing.
So he knew all about it. So mm-hmm. That's kind of why I was sort of obsessed with doing it.
Of course, of course. I'd be enamored of that. Now, if you have something to promote, we'll get this episode out sooner. If not, it'll be out in a while. But if you want to promote the show, we can get this
out.
Well,
we have 2 more weeks left of Shakespeare in the Park.
Okay.
So we're doing A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Mm-hmm.
The seldom seen A Midsummer Night's Dream, mm-hmm. in which I'm mm-hmm. playing Bottom,
mm-hmm.
or as he likes to be referred to, Nicholas Bottome. and Titus Andronicus, everyone's family-friendly crowd pleaser.
Uh-huh.
Which is actually, I think, one of the more enjoyable things. I mean, I think everything we've done is highly enjoyable.
Sure.
But this is, I'm having a riot doing this. It's, you know, it's not Shakespeare's masterpiece,
mm-hmm.
but it's a lot of fun, and it's like watching a Sam Peckinpah movie. It's dark, yeah. and we do advise people to maybe not bring children, under 12 maybe.
Okay.
But there's lots of blood and some pretty dark and vicious things happening. And, mm-hmm. And sort of dark humor in it. We're actually, you know, it's not as, some people think it's going to be this really heavy, grim mm-hmm. thing, but it's not, you know. So that goes through September 2nd, and they're running in repertory. You can find information on iscla.org, and if you're listening to this after September 2nd,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure we're doing lots of other things. Our Christmas Carol is coming out at Christmas time, in which I play Charles Dickens with just a CK. performing a Christmas Carol with a lovely assistant.
I can attest to that being wonderful. It's a great show.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And we have a one-person show. We're recording this in our new studio facility in Atwater. We have a one-person show called Letters from Home. That's in October. And then I don't know what we're doing in the spring. Mm-hmm. I'll have to come up with something.
All right. You doing stand-up for 2 hours.
Don't tempt me.
The George Formby life story. Ooh, there we go.
The George Formby life story?
Yes.
There's a huge market for that in L.A.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
Queuing around the block to find out who he is.
Well, thank you for doing the show, as always.
Thanks for having me back.
Welcome back anytime. It's been a while.
That'd
so
be
you're welcome back. We'll talk about Peter Sellers, whatever the hell you want. We'll talk about the two Aroundings. I don't care. Talk about whatever you like. I'm just going to tell people to go to CelerySoundRecords.com. That's where I'm releasing comedy albums slowly but surely, including my own sometime later this year. That's about it. Thank you guys for listening. And as always,
Have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. You can email us at podcast@comedyonvinyl.com. You can also send snail mail to Stolen Dress Entertainment, P.O. Box 805, Burbank, California, 91503. Subscribe to Comedy on Vinyl on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you can find podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and write us a review. It helps. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Comedy on Vinyl, or find everything in one place at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune in to the new Stand Up Records channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast. Visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, watch videos, and imbibe freely of our multimedia content going back 15 plus years.